Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 6 a.m.
Welcome to this week's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American Sunday Business and Oil Sections, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the oil report of the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, September 13th. Industry warns of consequences of federal leasing ban. The story was written by Melanie McEwen. With the presidential election in full swing, the nation's energy industry is making sure its economic contributions don't go unnoticed. In reaction to Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's proposal to eventually end leasing for oil and gas development on public lands and waters, various industry associations issued reports detailing the impact of such a ban. While there are few federal lands onshore Texas, the ban would impact offshore activity in the Gulf of Mexico, hitting Gulf Coast states like Texas and Louisiana particularly hard. Quote, "It might be a surprise to Texans to learn of the negative consequences if that policy is enacted," Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by telephone. Such a ban would cost Texans nearly 120,000 jobs, quote, "at a time when industry is on the long road to recovery from the pandemic. Policies like this further impair that recovery," Staples said. It would also cost the state $65 million in revenues that fund infrastructure, education, and health care, he added. Quote, "These are real numbers on tangible program measures," he said. "It would be a setback to the state government that is already billions short. This is not the right time," end quote. In New Mexico, which accounts for 57% of federal onshore oil production and 31% of onshore natural gas production, a ban would cost more than 62,000 jobs by 2022. With nearly 40% of the state's budget funded by natural gas and oil production, a ban could put at risk more than $1 billion of federal revenue sharing, which helps support New Mexico's education and conservation programs, according to the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association. NMOGA said a ban would result in oil production falling by 47% and natural gas production 46%. Staples said TXOGA, NMOGA, the Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association, and other industry associations are issuing such data to raise awareness that policies matter. Policies, he said, impact economic growth, job creation, and vital services like roads, schools, health care, and first responders. Quote, "Everyone should care about a healthy oil and gas economy," he said. "No industry is investing more in environmental protection than the energy industry," Staples said, pointing to efforts to improve and expand carbon capture, use and storage technology, leak detection and repair, and artificial intelligence to improve environmental protection. Quote, "This is about American energy security, the ability to produce domestic energy this country needs," he said. "Not getting this right has dire consequences," end quote. Banning oil and gas leasing on federal lands would result in a 68% drop in offshore natural gas production and 44% decline in oil production, while U.S. oil imports would rise by 2 million barrels a day, and the country would spend $500 million more on energy from foreign suppliers, according to an analysis commissioned by the American Petroleum Institute. The study said U.S. gross domestic product would fall a total $700 billion by 2030, put more than $9 billion in government revenues at risk, and cost nearly 1 million jobs by 2022. Americans, said Staples, understand the importance of affordable, reliable energy and overwhelmingly value energy security and affordability, Staples said. In fact, a poll by Morning Consult found two-thirds of voters in key battleground and other states would more likely vote for candidates who support access to domestic oil and natural gas. Operators say small-cap public companies still needed. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Consolidation in the energy industry is expected as operators merge to gain economies of scale during an uncertain economic climate. But some small-cap public companies say they still have a place in the energy landscape, and representatives of two companies discussed their experiences during the weekly Oil Field Strong webinar presented by OTA Compression, OTA Environmental, Kymark, and the Permian Basin Petroleum Association. Quote, "One thing for sure is that the oil and gas industry is going to be around a long time," said Robert Anderson, president and chief executive officer of Earthstone Energy. Quote, "There will be companies of all sizes for various reasons. We think size doesn't necessarily mean inefficient. The proof in the pudding is that small companies can be very efficient, cost-conscious, and competitive on a margin basis. Lack of scale and size does impact capital markets. It does make it difficult to raise funds in times like this. Being a public company gives us access not just to public equity markets, but private equity markets. I believe long-term there is going to be small-cap public companies. The need is out there for investors who want to take that risk for capital appreciation with smaller guys versus Exxon, which is a totally different type of investment," end quote. Observed David Fowler, president of Ring Energy, quote, "It's interesting to see how public markets have changed in just the last 3 years. In early 2018, a lot of institutional investors began to look at the industry and realized the amount of money they had pumped into the industry as $2 to $3 billion. They were expecting returns to come back to them. They'd been investing heavily in the industry over the prior 10 years, and as a result, they expected to see dividends. We were taking those dollars and plowing them back into the ground. As a result, institutional investors pulled back a little, and capital markets began to fold as the energy industry was beginning to see the bloom come off the rose. Other industries were beginning to flourish with the tax breaks enacted in 2017. Investors began to see other opportunities to see good growth," end quote. Energy companies have seen capital dry up, not just from Wall Street, but from bankers, Fowler continued. But he sees cause for optimism. Quote, "We're in a cyclical market. I think we're at the bottom, and as we look upward, we see demand increase and large oil inventories roll off. After the election, things will get back to normal into 2021. I think we've reached the bottom and are looking to come out the other side. Those who can stomach it will look at us and say, yeah, this is a good time to get in," end quote. The industry needs to be a champion of how it contributes to economic growth and how hard it works to protect the environment, said Anderson. Quote, "It has to do with education, doing the right thing and getting better at education. Banks are spending more time talking with us about ESG, environment, social, and governance," he said. He said his company continues to highlight its actions related to ESG. The novel coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic may have taken the spotlight from ESG presently, he said, but ESG issues will come back next year. Quote, you learn to live with it, and what we've done at Earthstone is be proactive, he said. ESG concerns are not going away, agreed Fowler. Quote, it's an item you have to pay attention to. We've addressed it to a degree, but not near the degree we need to. The cool thing is that we check a lot of boxes on the E, S, and G side, and we do as good a job as we can to make sure that's more visible, he said. We've done a lot of internal focusing on ESG. As a result, we've got to make that visible, and we're in the process of putting that together now, and you'll see it on our website. WTGS Fall Symposium goes virtual this year. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Just as previous fall symposiums presented by the West Texas Geological Society have featured technical innovation, this year's edition will offer technical advances. Except this year, amid the novel coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic, the technical advances being showcased are those allowing for virtual meetings. Quote, the very first meeting the organizers had in March and April, we asked if we should hold it or call it off, said Judd Tudor, technical director of this year's symposium. Quote, it was easier to call it off, but we thought we could do something to help people, end quote. After all, he told the Reporter Telegram by telephone, quote, the WTGS is in the business of helping the community, helping geologists, helping other societies, end quote. What has been crafted is a virtual symposium to be held September 23rd that will feature 19 talks, a virtual field trip to the Guadalupe Mountains, led by Bob Lindsay, Bill Fairhurst, and Charles and Linda Sternbach, and include maps and discussions of the outcrops and a poster session. The only thing not being held virtually is the golf tournament, Tudor said. The event opens with a keynote speech from Scott Tinker, Charlie Cairns, and Bob Lukes that will pay tribute to the late Steve Ruppel, a longtime senior research scientist at the University of Texas Bureau of Economic Geology. Organizers decided on the SpotMe platform because it will allow participants to interact and virtually network. It will feature virtual vendors' booths, raffles and giveaways, linkable abstracts, pictures and biographies, chat rooms, attendee games that encourage networking, on-demand content, and digital sponsor recognition. Cost is $75. Users will be able to create their own profiles with photos and links to their own social media sites and their own articles. Tudor encouraged early registration to allow participants time to set up those profiles. Another benefit of going virtual is it will allow anyone anywhere, whether it's Midland or Houston or Calgary, to attend. Topics range from seismic and microseismic to geochemistry, geomechanics, and geomorphology, to petrophysics, sequence stratigraphy, private equity, and historic geology. Tudor said the talks will not be a rehash of old topics, but will let the presenters show, quote, the ingenuity that they've designed to move the community forward. Science will be shared and networking available if attendees want more knowledge, he said. If those interested in the symposium can't attend on September 23rd, Tudor said the site will be live for the next 30 days so registrants can log on, visit all the talks they're interested in, and the virtual vendors' booths. They won't, however, be able to participate in raffles or games, he said. Quote, this is a step forward in what we do, Tudor said. We plan to add this to the 2021 Fall Symposium and make it an additional thing we offer. Each year, there are more limitations on budgets, restrictions, and travel. Now we have cheaper admittance fees and lower costs, end quote.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, September 14th, 2020. This is the oil page. This article is entitled, "There's No Easy Fix to OPEC's Whack-A-Mole Problem." Commentary by Julian Lee Bloomberg. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries turned 60 this week, and the oil producer group is putting a brave face on its COVID-curtailed Diamond Jubilee. But rifts within the cartel are resurfacing as de facto leader Saudi Arabia struggles to maintain discipline among members itching to pump more crude. The birthday celebrations, due to be held in Baghdad's Al-Shab Hall, where OPEC came into being, have been postponed as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. That may be a blessing, as the OPEC family gathering would have been a lot more like the Simpsons and a lot less like the Waltons, to misquote former U.S. President George H.W. Bush. Rifts have always existed among a membership that for most of the group's life has ranged between 12 and 15 very different countries, whose only unifying characteristic has been an economic overdependence on oil exports. The differences at the heart of OPEC have never been more obvious than they were in the mid-1980s, when it embarked on an ill-fated attempt to create a rules-based mechanism for allocating oil production targets. Members submitted preferred criteria for setting quotas along with their suggestions for weighting them. Not surprisingly, the Arabian countries of the Persian Gulf, with tiny populations and huge amounts of crude, favored criteria based on their wealth of oil reserves. By contrast, countries with large populations and limited oil reserves favored socioeconomic considerations, such as population size or the level of external debt. The whole initiative was eventually allowed to wither away, having done little more than expose the deep fault line that cut right through the group. That existential schism is the backdrop for OPEC's perennial problem: getting members to stick to the production targets they agree to. The cartel has never found an effective way to overcome this free rider problem. The Arabian Peninsula's high reserves, low population countries have, in general, been much better at sticking to their output targets than the rest, the recent exception being Iraq, which was exempt from quotas from 1990 to 2017 due to war, sanctions, and the need to rebuild its shattered economy. Recently, it looked as though Saudi Arabia's new oil minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, had hit on a solution. Rather than turning a blind eye to cheating and shouldering a disproportionate share of the burden of balancing supply and demand, he has publicly shamed the cheats and demanded they make up for their initial failures to cut as much as they had promised. It was never going to be easy to overturn a situation that had persisted for decades, yet the prince has been nothing if not persistent, and his determination is bearing fruit. But it's turning into a frustrating game of whack-a-mole. No sooner has one cheat been brought to book than another pops up. The two biggest culprits, Iraq and Nigeria, have both promised deeper cuts and even appear to be trying to implement them. But that's highlighted the shortcomings of others, notably Russia, the non-OPEC counterweight to Saudi Arabia, in the enlarged, almost four-year-old OPEC Plus alliance, so crucial to making any difference in a pandemic-plagued world. Russia has implemented about 95% of the outcut it pledged in April, according to figures presented to the OPEC Plus Group's Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee, JMMC. That's a lot better than during the alliance's first agreement that ran from the start of 2017 until the end of March. But its production is still about 100,000 barrels a day above its target, making it the second biggest overproducer in July in volume terms. And yet no one, not even ABS, as the Saudi oil minister is commonly known, is calling the country out. Why has Russia been given a free pass? Perhaps there's a sense the country has implemented deeper cuts than many expected after it walked away from the previous OPEC Plus deal. Or perhaps the Saudis feel it's unwise to antagonize such an important partner, especially one that's historically been treated with suspicion by OPEC. The next problem to pop up may be even more embarrassing for Saudi Arabia: compliance questions concerning the United Arab Emirates, the kingdom's longtime ally. By its own admission, the UAE has pumped about 100,000 barrels a day more than it should have in August due to peak summer electricity demand, putting its compliance at 82%. But that may be an understatement, according to the so-called secondary sources OPEC relies on to monitor its deal. This spells the potential for more unwanted friction when the JMMC meets later this week. It's really a bad sign that one of the more disciplined members is now changing its tune. It will make it more difficult to convince other producers to continue to toe the line. It's a real shame, coming just as the group would prefer to celebrate its successes rather than dwell on its challenges. And there have been successes, a major one being the record 9.7 million barrels a day cut from global supply, thanks to the current OPEC Plus arrangement with 10 non-OPEC allies that Saudi Arabia is trying to hold together. I remain convinced that, despite the group's very obvious shortcomings, oil markets have been a lot less volatile because of its existence over the past 60 years. A world without OPEC, or some similar group, would be far from paradise.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, September 13th, 2020. The Bear Emerges from Hiding by Dennis Elam, assistant professor at Texas A&M San Antonio and a 1966 graduate of Andrews High School. www.themarketperspective.com. U.S. oil prices have slid 12% since the end of August, and on Tuesday notched their biggest one-day drop since June. The NASD and the S&P both fell for four of the last 5 days. Quote from Oil Traders Brace for Turmoil, Tech Stocks Lead Lower, Friday, Wall Street Journal. To understand the oil market, one needs to look at the entire complex of crude, gasoline, and heating oil. Unleaded gasoline, in particular, tells the story of a market unable to sustain a rally. Gasoline futures peaked, along with stocks, in February at $1.80. Prices fell into late March, dropping to 50 cents. A counter-trend rally could not penetrate the falling 200-day moving average. Since August, the price has peaked at $1.25 and now $1.10. As we have noted over the years, falling energy prices are indicative of a weak economy, not the other way around. We noted that among the major international oils, a drop of a dollar or two, no matter which stock, would break fragile support that existed through the summer. That has now happened to ExxonMobil, COP, CVX, and BP. As with gasoline, all are below all four moving averages, one track. This suggests much lower prices ahead. A front page Wall Street Journal article notes, the jobs recovery loses steam. It did not take long for Brooks Brothers and J. Crew to file for bankruptcy. Less noticed are thousands of smaller businesses suffering from slowdown. Dry cleaners, shoe repair, taxis, and rent cars all suffer from reduced air travel, hotel bookings, and empty restaurants. Luxury goods are hard hit, with LVMH backing out of its $16.02 billion takeover of Tiffany. September is a seasonal down month. October is known for famous lows such as 1929 and 1987. The DJIA topped September 3rd at 29,199, falling 1,100 intraday points. This column spent the summer warning of narrowing breadth. It took until that day for the FANG stocks to reverse. The DJIA Thursday closed at 27,534, down about 1,650 points from the September 3rd high. Momentum indicators are being quickly oversold. Expect some size upward bounces, but I doubt a recovery is in the cards. Our proxy stock, Cullen Frost, topped around $95 in February, dropped to $50 in March, and recovered to $83 in June. That is when the vast majority of stocks, excluding techs, topped. Now CFR has fallen below all four MAs to $67.74. Banks are indicative of social mood. Positive mood has companies borrowing, negative mood, bankruptcy. Well, not so much. And CFR earned $93 million last quarter. It appears poised for lower prices, much like oil stocks. As an aside, lakefront property is seeing a boom in demand. Real estate is a second derivative of the stock market. I suspect many are paying a premium for those properties now, even as the stock market issues an early warning of trouble ahead. The Economist. Bigger Than GDP by Emre Perryman, head of the Perryman Group. According to a new report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, CBO, the amount of federal debt held by the public is projected to exceed gross domestic product, GDP, for the first time next year. This assessment is consistent with current and projected patterns and thus likely to occur. The CBO is projecting a federal budget deficit of $3.3 trillion in 2020, more than triple the shortfall recorded in 2019. Most of the spike is due to the economic disruption caused by the coronavirus pandemic and the initial legislation enacted in response. Such a deficit would be about 16% of GDP, the largest since 1945. The deficit is financed by increasing federal debt held by the public, which the CBO expects to be 98% of GDP in 2020, over 100% in 2021, and 107% in 2023, which would be the highest in the nation's history. Gross domestic product is the final value of all goods and services produced in the U.S. economy, which can be thought of as somewhat parallel to households' total income, but on an economy-wide scale. From an economic perspective, the fact that debt will be larger than GDP is frankly not all that significant. Many households with a mortgage, for example, have experienced periods when the amount of their debt exceeded annual income. Lenders anticipate this situation in making home loans, and unlike the government, households are not able to legally print money. For the U.S. to have debt greater than GDP is not, in and of itself, a major concern. Clearly, the pandemic sped up the pace, but the trajectory of debt growing faster than GDP has been in place a while. The current situation merely causes the lines to cross a couple of years sooner. The U.S. has long been mismanaging finances, allowing deficits to spiral during a lengthy expansion. Ultimately, getting a handle on deficits is essential for fiscal health, but now is not the time to focus on them. The U.S. economy is in a precarious position, with many of the temporary COVID relief measures expiring, even though the virus is not yet controlled and millions of Americans remain out of work. Pressure is mounting, and many are facing evictions, foreclosures, food insecurity, business closures, loss of health insurance, and other severe dislocations. The economy was strategically sound going into the pandemic, but without support could experience growing problems. Folks who had no problem exploding spending and cutting taxes during a decade of prosperity should not suddenly be gripped by austerity at a time of unprecedented crisis. The simple fact that the debt will exceed GDP next year is no reason to ignore a genuine national emergency. Stay safe.
Thank you for joining us for this week's readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American Sunday Business and Oil sections. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile.
Starting Friday on the Noon Book Hour, Faith by Jimmy Carter. In this powerful and personal reflection, President Carter contemplates how faith has sustained him in happiness and disappointment, and considers how we may find it in our own lives. All his life, President Carter has been a courageous exemplar of faith. Now he shares the lessons he's learned. He writes, "I have included a description of the ways my faith has guided and sustained me, as well as how it has challenged and driven me to seek a closer and better relationship with people and with God." President Carter describes his belief in religious freedom, moral politics, and the place of prayer in daily life. He describes how to accept it, live it, how to doubt, and find faith again. This is a serious and moving reflection from one of America's most admired and respected citizens. Faith by Jimmy Carter, starting Friday at noon and Saturday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Welcome to this week's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American Sunday Lifestyle sections, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear